Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here with you today. Awfully glad you joined me today. I hope you had a great weekend. I had a very busy weekend doing around the house stuff, so I am glad to be sitting here upright, happy that I have another week of work, and we got a great show. Jack Alexander is going to be with us in just a minute. He wrote a book called The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. And boy, that we are short on mercy in this world today. So we're going to talk to him in just a minute. I saw a little bit of good news over the weekend. When you see something that kind of is heartwarming, there was a Chicago Cubs baseball game, and found it interesting that a first base coach, flipped a ball into the stands to a boy who was sitting in the front row. Ball got away from him though, and it rolled underneath the seats, and that's when a guy a couple rows behind him picked up the ball and handed it to the woman he was with. And then the folks in the second row had kind of a good laugh, but the boy and the adults in the first row, not so much. But that was before the Cubs saw the video. So the team bought the boy two balls, including one signed by All-Star second baseman Javier Baez. So that's kind of a nice story. I like hearing that stuff. Chicago's got a little bit of a publicity problem anyway. They just were named the rat capital of the country. That's lovely. They have the largest number of rat complaints last year. So congratulations, Chicago. I would think it would be New York, but it's not. It's Chicago. So Chicago was one, then followed by New York, Washington, D.C., and then Boston. All right. No more rat stories. Let's get interested with our topic coming up, which is God's mercy. I'm very excited to talk to Jack. He's already on the studio line. We'll get him in just a minute. But let's start with Psalm chapter 6, verse 9. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayer. It's 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and then bring on Jack Alexander.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way, you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear, simply because your program came on when you had an appointment, you were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
It is 7 minutes after the hour. It seems like mercy is the one thing that has the power to bring relief, hope, and healing to a very hurting world. It seems like we're short of it. We don't show mercy very often, or we're not merciful towards others. So my guest, Jack Alexander, has written a book called The God Impulse. Jack is chairman of the Reimagine Group and senior fellow at the Sagamore Institute, author of The God Guarantee. He's been a previous recipient of an Ernst & Young National Entrepreneur of the Year Award. So, Jack, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. Great to be here.
I love your endorsements. You got them all. You got good ones. You must have struck a nerve.
It's a topic that that we're all should be very interested in.
Yeah, because mercy will help in healing a broken relationship or, just opening up our hearts to the people who are around us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's when you look at the news cycle, it's almost like mercy and truth are yelling at each other rather than coming together and providing healing.
And it's always it was God's first impulse, I think you say, to show mercy to a broken world. And we're not really doing that, are we?
Yeah, it was in Ephesians 2. God the Father saw the broken world, and out of the riches of his mercy made us alive in Christ. He sent Christ because of his mercy. In the Good Samaritan, the Samaritan represents God and also hopefully us. He saw a beaten enemy, and his first impulse was to, he saw him and he felt compassion for him.
I love it. Jack, you had you experienced a coupling of God's mercy and truth in your life, didn't you?
Yeah, I sure did. I became a Christian when I was 26, and I experienced the vertical mercy from God, through Christ. And, God has just been gracious in giving me many opportunities to both receive mercy from others and grant it.
So mercy is, it's a contagious thing. It's has a ripple effect, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And really, every time you show mercy to somebody, there's a reason not to. I give an example in my book of a guy who actually had been stealing on his expense reports. And he was a terrific guy. He was hanging around with some people who weren't good influences. And we had an opening for someone to run one of our divisions. And I called him in and I told him I believed in him. And I said that every month I'd come visit him and we would watch everything he did. I never talked about the expense reports. We promoted him, and the sales of that division went up, I think, 30-fold in the next 8 years when he was president of it. So it's, I think mercy is not just something that we do. I think it's something that works.
Well, Jack, let's just backtrack just a little bit. Maybe we should, define what we mean by mercy.
Yeah, mercy is where, think of relief relief coming in a time of relationship, and with kindness. So it's really kindness, relief in the context of a relationship.
Okay, so when Christians are working towards trying to be more merciful, how does that connect to the God impulse?
Well, I think every time mercy always asks the question, what's your story? If one of my children has been disobedient, before I go and discipline them, I'll always sit down with them and say, what's going on? What happened? And oftentimes I have three sons, one of them could be defiant when I ask them that, and one could break down and cry, and one, basically, truth has boundaries and would need discipline. And the second one, I'd pray with both of them, but the second one I might hug and just show mercy to.
So that's also really wise parenting, too.
Well, and it applies to any relationship. I mean, think of marriage, where we're so close to another person 24/7, and sometimes they'll say something or do something. And I think that ability to stop and have that impulse and just say, hey, how are you doing? What caused you to do this or to say this? Where you're basically giving the person an opportunity to share what's in their heart, because the nature of us, I love the quote that it's like we want mercy for ourselves and justice for everybody else. and it's just that tendency we have, especially people like myself and you who have high views of the truth. We see this, there's 47 different couplings of mercy and truth in Scripture. And if we really represent God's character, we need to represent both of those in balance. And basically, the book suggests that conservatives can have a high view of truth and a lower view of mercy. Liberals try to take the high ground on mercy and have a lower view of truth. And so it's what you see in society, and it's what you see in relationships. So I think this understanding that God's heart, I think there were 40 times in the Gospels that Jesus saw and he had compassion. And you and I both know that you can see someone superficially, or you can see somebody, see their heart. And oftentimes we need to ask them, what's your story? What's going on before we make any sort of judgment?
Mm-hmm. Jack, what's the difference between showing mercy and just feeling sorry for somebody? I think I can do that readily, where I just feel so sorry for somebody. But maybe that's not the right response.
I think mercy is an engaged heart. I can feel sorry for you and your circumstance, but my heart might not be engaged with you. And I think that's the amazing thing that Jesus did. You know, in Matthew 9, it said, everywhere Jesus went, he preached and he healed. And then he told us to go preach and heal. And so you see this coupling of truth and mercy. And imagine if you were a leper, your skin would be the most, you'd be most self-conscious about that. Jesus would go up and touch the skin, look in the eyes. A blind man had touched the eyes, put mud in the eyes of a blind man. He did things so intimately. And I think that that's what we're missing today. Microsoft came out with a study that said the average attention span of an adult is 8 seconds now. And so we move so fast. Goldfish have a 9-second attention span. Mm-hmm. So I think we're moving so fast, we don't have time to ask the other person about how they're doing, why they did what they did, why they said what they did, and really give them the benefit of the doubt.
That's really interesting, Jack. As a radio host, I never say anything that lasts longer than 7 seconds.
Well, I'm sorry if any of my responses have been longer than
No, you're my guest. I want you to do all the talking. I'm just saying, I think you're right. I think the attention spans are really short. But anyway, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, my guest, Jack Alexander, I'm going to ask him about a nationwide study that was done by the Barna Group. And Jack, yeah, about what 83% of Christians do not believe. So with that as a cliffhanger, we'll take a short break and be back with Jack Alexander in just a minute.
The rising of the sun to the going down of the same. You are my God, and all I want to do is praise your name. I praise your name and lift our voices.
We were not gone too long, and we're back already with Jack Alexander. He's written a book called The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. Recently did a study with the Barna Group and came up with kind of a shocking conclusion that 83% of Christians do not believe, and Jack, I'm going to let you fill in the rest.
Yeah, they don't believe that mercy is their responsibility. In my book, I talked about this concept of the outsourcing of compassion. So instead of seeing and feeling, we think it's the responsibility of the government or the church or Christian organizations. So only the inverse of that number, only 17% of Christians felt like it was their responsibility. And Tim Keller, in his endorsement of the book, linked this sort of under-representation of mercy to lost people not feeling love from the church.
And that's a real thing. And it's interesting that 83% of Christians do not believe that mercy is their individual responsibility, but rather the responsibility of churches and nonprofits. That's a statistic we gotta chew on.
Yeah, and the number of nonprofits has exploded. I mean, I love nonprofits, but there's 1.6 million of them now, and they represent 9% of our economy. And Bill, as you know, a large percentage of their costs are overhead. And whether it's, I mean, last year my wife helped a girl who was jobless and her teeth were rotting, and she took her to a clinic 6 weeks in a row, and she has new dentures, and she got a new job, and, you know, just feels so much better about herself. And we couldn't have outsourced that to someone.
Isn't that the truth? That's a beautiful story. Jack, why do we have a compromised view of mercy today?
Well, another one of the data points in the mercy study is by a factor of 5-1, Bill, Christians think that victims and people in distress deserve mercy more than, let's say, a prisoner or someone who's sinned against them. And the heart of the gospel is that I'm a lawbreaker. And in a way, mercy is something that you don't give because people deserve it. And so when I love someone and forgive someone who's sinned against me, hopefully they've repented, or someone who's in prison, I think that there's a difference between somebody having sick circumstances and having sickness in their soul that's causing them to sin. And Jesus said he didn't come for the healthy. He came for those who are sick. So I think that there's a huge implication here that if even when we're giving mercy, we're giving it to, and rightfully so, to a hurricane victim or to someone who's out of work. But that's, I think, biblical mercy extends to sinners. And I mean, if you look at Stephen and Jesus, people who are who meant to kill them said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing."
Mm-hmm. Jack, I need to give you 3 days to answer this question, but what does God's words say about the absolute importance of mercy?
Well, you know, I'll say two quick things. You know, one, when God represented himself in the Ark of the Covenant, you know, it had the commandments, it had the truth in the Ark, along with a budded staff and the bowl of manna. But sitting on top of the Ark was the mercy seat, and that's where his presence actually went. In Exodus, when Moses said, "Show me your glory," the first thing God said about himself was, "I'll show mercy to whom I show mercy." So I think mercy is such an enormous part of God's character, and yet if you read a book called The Summary of Christian Doctrine, it deserves one sentence in a 184-page book. So that's what caused me to write this book, is I saw, and it came out in the Barna research, that only 25% of pastors really learn much about mercy in seminary.
Mm. Jack, I speak on every Friday night to a group of men recovering from alcohol and drug addiction, and I showed them a clip from Les Miserables, I don't know, must have been 6 weeks ago, of this scene where Jean Valjean actually assaults the bishop in the middle of the night and then steals the silver and leaves, and he's arrested by the council, and they bring him back, and the bishop says, "I'm so mad at you, you left without the candlesticks." And the police are like, "You mean you gave this to him?" "Yes, I did." And I showed it to these guys, and I said, "Here's a great illustration of grace." And one guy came up to me afterwards and said, "No, that wasn't grace, that was mercy." And I've been thinking about that ever since. And I don't know, what is the difference between grace and mercy?
Well, first of all, the conclusion of my book, I call it Gasp, because in Les Miserables, that's what the audience does when the bishop says that. They just gasp, because when we're shown mercy, when we should get punishment, which is really the definition of grace, of mercy, whereas grace is undeserved favor. But think of the last thing the bishop whispered to Jean Valjean. He said, "Tonight I have bought your soul for God."
Mm-hmm.
And literally, if anybody's listening on this radio station and they are struggling with forgiveness with someone, think of that one statement, because in effect, God compares the worst thing we've done to bind our souls, which what Christ did. And we have, in my book, I say it's the one case where God really allows us to play God, to forgive somebody that doesn't deserve it. And it's just, that's such a powerful clip that you show those guys, and I actually talk about it in the book.
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it's hard to talk to a person that is biblically illiterate about grace, because it's, or mercy. Because they don't really they've never experienced it. And what does it look like to feel God's mercy? And sometimes I just I look for little illustrations that might give them a glimpse.
Well, think of maybe a bad thing you've done in your life, and if you walk into a very truth-oriented environment, you may resist wanting to share what you did or what you said. And sometimes you walk into an environment and you just meet someone and you know you can trust them. You mm-hmm. know they're a merciful person and you can tell them your deepest secret. And I think that that's the trouble sometimes with conservative churches, and I go to a conservative church, is that sometimes we compromise mercy, but we never compromise truth. And that can end up being harsh.
Mm-hmm. Jack Alexander is my guest, and the book that he wrote is The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. Jack, how do we, you know, this is maybe a very broad question, but how do we learn to just love others more and find new ways to show mercy?
Well, the Good Samaritan is the parable that Jesus gave us to really govern our relationships. And the book is organized around the four areas to see, go, do, and endure. And sometimes we see something and we don't have really a chance to do something for the person or go to them, but we can just pray. Sometimes we can go to them and we might call 911. We might pray for them there. And it's like what I call on-ramps and off-ramps in these four steps that the Samaritan takes. And, you know, Jesus didn't heal everyone. And so we really need to prayerfully, but it starts with a God impulse of seeing and feeling. And I think that's where we can be so busy that we cannot see and feel. And I have a section in the book at the end of chapter 3 that talks about the rewards of mercy. And Bill, there are more rewards, life, family, met needs, health, guidance and prayers, delivery and protection. It just goes on and on to those who show mercy. And so I think it's just really an undertaught and underemphasized area. And so that's the reason I wrote the book.
Jack, when I watch the news and you see the venom that's exchanged between people, and you think they're out just to kill each other. Basically, all they do is there's no mercy either direction. So we don't really see it very often. If you turn the TV on and watch the news, you see anything but mercy.
Well, Christians are the ones who should break the cycle. You know, we're the ones who've received mercy. And in the scripture actually calls us vessels of mercy. So we're the ones who are called to love our enemies and to pray for those who persecute us. And so I think that if somebody is against us, I think it takes humility, like in this immigration thing where one side says, well, you're not a country without laws, and we already have immigration laws, but perhaps children are being separated from their parents and they're not being cared for. So I think that we need to have humility as Christians to try to integrate mercy into our truth, into our boundaries, and have an engaged heart rather than just saying we're right.
It's really a good reminder. It's powerful because mercy is like the Barna Research Group came out with. Christians think it's not their job. This is an eye-opener, Jack. It really is interesting.
Well, and when you think of Jesus, he went to Pharisees and he taught them parables of mercy, whether it's the prodigal son, mm-hmm. whether it's the good Samaritans, and he went to sinners and he said, go and sin no more. You know, so I think that again, unchecked, a love for truth can end up in Phariseeism.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus would get most upset at the Pharisees, and unchecked, mercy can end up in lawlessness where there's no boundaries.
Yeah.
And so those are the two extremes, and Jesus had an answer for each extreme.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that God led you to write this book. I think it's certainly has made me think. I appreciate you coming on the show and being a guest.
Well, it's been a delight, Bill.
Thanks, Jack. Jack Alexander has been my guest, and his book is called The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
No matter what trials life presents, singer Laura Story knows firsthand God's blessings through it all. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count, and Laura has written a song about the blessings she's seen despite a very dark time in her life.
The song Blessings started off more as a diary entry as I was reflecting one day just on how different my life looks than what I expected it to be. As a songwriter, I'm not necessarily writing about like these truths that I've mastered as much as I'm writing about what God's teaching me right now. And it really is this idea of saying, you know, God, I don't understand my story. I don't understand your ways, but I am believing that there are blessings that you bring about even through the hardest of trials.
No matter what you might be facing, God loves you, and he's right there with you to see you through the circumstance. Do you want to hear more encouragement like this? Go to makingyourlifecount.com.
Welcome to the show. I'm always glad when I have a visit from Dr. Ken Kaiser, chair of the communications department here at the University of Northwestern. And I always love his take on what's going on in politics and the world. And Kent, as always, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk a little bit about the judge-to-be, Brett Kavanaugh. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a good choice. He wasn't my first choice. My first one, I think many of us cultural conservatives thought that Amy Barrett would have been the greatest choice ever. But Kavanaugh is really a good choice. And I think that both sides should like him. But, I mean, I know there's going to be a huge, huge fight, you know, and it's because the confirmation of judges has just become that way. You know, it's like I don't know if you know the story, but back in 1922, when Warren Harding was president, he made a nomination of a guy who wasn't even in town. The opening took place, and it was filled in one day. The guy came back and found out that he was a Supreme Court justice. wouldn't it be nice if that were the way it works today? You know, but I think Kavanaugh is a savvy guy. I think that he'll get through the confirmation hearings well. I don't think it'll be easy. I think he'll get through them decently. He's got a long paper trail, a long record of decisions and opinions on various issues. The one that the Senate is likely to hone in on, of course, is abortion, because that's become the number one issue for Democrats when it comes to the appointment of Supreme Court justices. And I'm hoping that it's going to become a little bit of a problem for the Democrats, actually, at this point, because they've taken such an extreme view. We're at this point now where listeners might remember there was a time when a baby was aborted, but lived for 21 days. And a judge said, well, you know, the way the law is that there is no protection for that fetus. He called it a fetus. Because it had been aborted, like thrown away. So, that's the Democrats' position at this point, is that if it was meant to be aborted, then it's not a person.
Wow.
Even if it survives after the failed abortion. And there have been other instances like that where the abortion has failed. And so they actually had to pass legislation, the Congress did, about the – if a baby is born alive after it's supposed to be aborted, which is ridiculous, isn't it? And that's what the Democrats' position is at this point, that Roe v. Wade extends to the living child. If the intent of the parent was to abort the child or to kill the child. And I don't think Kavanaugh will be this much of a wisecrack to ask a question back to the senators, whether they support that was the Obama position, by the way, that extreme position. I don't think he'll do that, but I think the Democrats will question him at their peril, because they could be, of course, boxed in by their fellow senators from the conservative side on this particular issue. And that's politically an obviously extreme position, and in an election year for the Democratic Party to be exposed as being that extreme, because it's only a few, very few Democrats today who vote pro-life, literally a handful.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a little stuck on that 21-day, the baby that lived 21 days after the baby was supposed to be aborted. That's just takes my breath away.
Right. Well, it wasn't, again, the judge said it wasn't a baby, that it was a fetus, because the intent was for it to die. And of course, we've heard of – there are many cases like this where there's a botched abortion, and then the baby is put in a room to die. It's uncomfortable to talk about, but that's the Democrat position today, that's the Democratic Party's position at this point. And so that's where they stand when they're talking about preserving Roe v. Wade. It's not just in the case of life, incest, race, health of the mother, or anything else. It extends to that extreme position of it's not a life until it leaves the hospital if the parents want it.
Crazy.
But anyway, I think that that's certainly the issue that's going to come up. That's going to be the prime issue when Kavanaugh goes to the confirmation hearings. Other than that, I think that he's probably going to get by pretty easily. I think that there will be some senators like Elizabeth Warren who will go after him for being, I don't know, too pro-corporation. But, you know, the whole Supreme Court – I mean, the Supreme Court is pro-corporation now as it stands. So it's not like he's going to change the makeup of the Supreme Court if he's appointed in that regard, because he would just follow along with Justice Kennedy in his footsteps in terms of corporate law and so on. And I think that both parties should like where he stands on basically what we call administrative law.
Mm-hmm.
Administrative law, there are administrative laws, and those are the laws that bind government. Like, government has to operate according to administrative laws and administrative rules. And this isn't a partisan thing. Both Democrats and Republicans agree that government itself has to play by the rules, and that there have to be limits on what the government can do. And so he's been very strong on reining in government and making government follow the rules. And I think both sides should appreciate that. But that's not what obviously that's not where the controversy is going to be. The Democrats are really going to go after him on the pro-life issue.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting, Kent, when I see a news report of some celebrity who's revealing that she's pregnant. Reporters and other people who write articles will say so-and-so was seen yesterday sporting a baby bump.
Right. They call it a baby when it's convenient. No, it's really interesting. One of my colleagues once did an analysis of media coverage and looking at when did they use the term fetus and when did they use the term baby. And they're terribly inconsistent. I mean, mm-hmm. Of course, you know, you're consistent if you just call it a baby. But when it's convenient for them with their ideology or their worldview to call it a fetus, then they do. If they don't want it to be recognized as a human life, then they call it a fetus. And you know, this was – I know the Star Tribune is part of that analysis – the Minneapolis Star Tribune, that is, and it was very inconsistent
mm-hmm.
in when they used those terms. I mean, they would, and the thing is that my colleague kind of asked them about, oh, no, we're very consistent, but then did the analysis and found that, no, they were really inconsistent about it.
I mean, that expression resonates with everybody, though. You see a pregnant woman and go, oh, she's sporting a baby bump, or, you know, that's what everyone thinks. She's has a baby.
Right.
Nobody.
Well, and the thing is, like, you know, we've made these strides scientifically and so on over the last 20 years or something. It's been about, I think, 20, 25 years since the Supreme Court kind of reaffirmed Roe v. Wade. Things have changed a lot since then. All of a sudden now we've got babies who can survive at a point. Not long ago, the Senate actually voted on the Democrats actually voted against legislation that would have prevented or, you know, made it illegal to have an abortion after I can't remember how many weeks, but babies are actually surviving earlier than that
mm-hmm.
now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've got – I think it was all but three of the Democrats in the Senate voted against that legislation. So here you've got all these people who are saying that these babies who are surviving could be susceptible to being killed, you know, and science has changed a lot in 20, 25 years, and people recognize, I think, more what is not what is a life. I think, and it's what people find to be compelling isn't even necessarily heartbeat or something. As heartbeat's interesting, I think you can detect that after 6 weeks with one test and 10 weeks after another test. But what's more compelling to people, I think, is when you say that the baby has fingerprints. That's my understanding, is that if you tell a pregnant woman, a pregnant girl, particularly teenage girl, that point of having fingerprints is the more compelling thing than a heartbeat, because it suggests individuality.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you know, as we learn more about biology and life and when it begins and so on, people are becoming more pro-life. I mean, you know, 2/3 of Americans now are not in the position that the Democratic Party is at this point. So, you know, in Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings, I actually kind of hope that the Democrats get kind of exposed for their extreme position.
Yeah. Kent, this is why I tell you I pay you the big bucks. I don't actually pay you the big bucks. I just tell you.
I wish I got paid.
I just tell you I'm going to pay you the big bucks. Dr. Kent Kaiser is my guest. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. In studio is Dr. Kent Kaiser. You may know him from previous episodes of being with me on the show. He's also the chair of communications here at the University of Northwestern, fresh back from a missions trip. I want to hear all about that. Go.
Yeah. For the past week or so, I was in a little Grand Rapids, Manitoba, which is a community of about 800 people that has no road, except in the winter. There's an ice road, but otherwise you have to fly into it. And this is my fourth trip there, not for consecutive years, but over the past 9 years I've been going there. This is the fourth time. The leader of the trip, the leader of my group, has been going there for 14 years. We teach vacation Bible school to about 80 kids there, and it's really a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. It's tough. It's a tough community. Like many Native communities, there's a lot of alcoholism and drugs and child abuse and spousal abuse and things. And this year they had a particularly difficult time because earlier in the year a giant forest fire forced the evacuation of the entire town. So they all had to go to Winnipeg for a month or two.
Wow.
And so the Red Cross put them up there. And then they only returned to their village a couple of weeks before we arrived with our vacation Bible school. And you could really tell, I mean, it was palpable what that meant for them to have to move away for a while and then come back. You know, it did in some ways bring them together, but at the same time, it was such upheaval that they were really trying to settle back in. And just to, and like one practical thing, you know, they left so fast that all the food spoiled in all the refrigerators and freezers. Now imagine that you can't drive in there, and they had to replace over 800 freezers and refrigerators so that the people could move back. And it was the fire took out the electric. So that's why the refrigerators and freezers all stopped working and so on. And so they're really trying to recover. But we teach vacation Bible school, and we also have activities for youth and older people too, actually, and really just try to build a relationship with the community. And I mean, just going back, every time I go back, people come up and welcome me back. And of course, I'm friends with some of them on Facebook and things like that too. So we keep in touch throughout the year. But it's challenging. It's, you know, we have a small group of people. This year we actually had six people. In the past when I've gone, we've only had three or four to manage 80 kids, and they're bouncing off the walls and things. But we get the gospel through to them, and it's amazing how much they actually pick up when you think that they're not even listening. And the older people really recognize in the community, they recognize the value of it. We often hear from the older people how they wish they had had it when they were a kid,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they all miss us. And when we're leaving, it's like, you're leaving already? You know, they would like us to stay. And so it's really gratifying, but it is tiring.
I bet.
Tiring work.
Now, when you go there, do you stay?
This is how I spend my vacation.
Yeah. You know? When you go there, do you stay at a Hilton or a Marriott property?
Yeah, this is funny. We stay actually where we are in this community. There's a Catholic church that we actually hold our vacation Bible school in. This is the Lutheran Association of Missionaries and Pilots. That's the sponsoring organization. But we stay in a Catholic We work in a Catholic church, and then attached to it is the rectory. So we stay in the Catholic priest's house. And I stayed in the utility room on a mattress.
So an upgrade from
last
year.
Yeah, there was a couple of gals who stayed in, you know, a regular bedroom. And then three actually slept in air mattresses on the priest's living room floor. And we make all our own meals there. There's no restaurant or anything right. like that. Although we can, it's funny, we can call the radio station there. It's a little community radio station if we need something. So if we wanted walleye, we just call the radio station and they say on the air that the missionaries want walleye. And within 5 minutes, we'll get 3 calls. You want walleye? I got walleye. Or this year, often in the past, we ordered moose, and stuff. But this year, with the refrigerators and freezers being out, we didn't ask for moose meat or anything, but we cook for ourselves, and so there's work beyond just teaching. It's the day to day life kind of work that we have to do over there. But in all of it, we get together with the community members, and again, it's about building those relationships and sharing the gospel, even when we're not teaching. Every day we go swimming in the lake, and as soon as we show up, we're like Pied Pipers, and we'll show up at the lake and all of a sudden there's 35 kids there swimming, and it's all that time to just sort of share and, in fellowship. And
yeah.
it's really powerful. And I think it empowers the parents and others in the community who are Christians too. They don't feel that they have the wherewithal to teach their own vacation Bible school or certainly not Sunday school throughout the year. So sometimes this is the only sort of churching that the kids receive, and you can really tell that they are glad that we're there to do it because they don't feel confident in themselves to do it. But this is a typical kind of Aboriginal community, First Nations. They're on a reserve, and they've been mistreated by the Canadian government in a big way. I mean, they were nomadic people, and the government came in and burned down their teepees and made them move into these little villages and in these extremely remote places where you have to fly in, and built their housing for them and took the kids away originally into residential schools. And so they're still feeling the effects of this, where the children were taken out of their parents' homes into residential schools in the city, in like Winnipeg or whatever city, and they're often abused there. And so the effects of that are still being felt as the parent-grandparent generation. Oftentimes they're on drugs or drinking and just, doing whatever they can to, I suppose, dull the pain of that experience of having been ripped out of their parents' homes and taken to these residential schools where they were abused by the nuns and the priests and whatever.
Wow, Kent, that's a big story. Oh, really? How did you even find this place?
Well,
I've known about it.
I don't even know. I've known about it since I was a kid, about Lutheran Association of Missionaries and Pilots. And there was a time when I was set to go on a mission trip to Africa, and it fell through at the last minute. So I called the LAMP office, which is in Edmonton, Alberta. And I said, well, I know you probably don't have anything for me this year, but probably for next year I'd be interested in. And the woman there was like, well, how about this year? And so she got me to go on a mission trip right away that year. Different village. This was, by the way, my 9th trip doing this. And after a couple of trips, they actually put me on the board of directors for LAMP. And so I was term limited out after a couple of terms, but I actually had been on the board of LAMP. So many trips up to Edmonton, and oftentimes meeting here because some of the board members are from Minnesota, because we have more Lutherans, within a 10-mile radius
right.
of U.S. Bank Stadium than they have in all of Canada.
Right, right.
I've been involved with that organization for a long time. I think it's really worthwhile. It's one of the biggest mission organizations in the world. We have about 400 missionaries who go out each year to dozens of communities in the far north. Everybody always thinks, too, and when they think of mission trips, I think everybody thinks about going to the south. Nobody ever thinks about going to the north, but the north has such a need. The population is increasing incredibly. If we had if we could double the number or triple the number of volunteers, we would have enough villages for people to serve.
It's such a powerful story. And how many days were you there?
8 days.
Yeah, that's a long time to be away from your creature comforts, isn't it?
Well, I don't mind. I mean, I always say in order to be a good missionary, there's two things. You have to be good at camping because you never know where you're going to sleep or what you're going to eat or things like that. And then you can have no personal space. You have to have a very small personal space because as soon as you're in that environment, the kids are going to be hanging on you and poking you and touching your arm because you have hair and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to poke your eyes because they're blue and they've never seen blue eyes before. Things like that.
Well, the eye poking, that sounds like fun. I mean, Who doesn't want a little eye poking?
Well, I mean, they're going to pull on you and things like this. They're going to hang on you. And if you're a guy, there's going to be at some point when a whole pack of them is going to decide they need to take you down during the week. So you got to be kind of prepared for that, too.
For an ambush?
Yes.
How did you do it with your ambush?
Well, I'm pretty big, so I stood my ground.
Yeah. Nobody got hurt?
No, nobody got hurt.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story, Kent. I'm inspired. I don't do short-term missions trip. I can't say I've really been on one, but this is a great story.
Anybody can do it. And I started doing it when a couple of my friends were doing medical mission trips, and I was like, you know, if they can do it, I can too.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, all the other people on the trip, there was one person who was younger this time. All the other people were older. I think the oldest person on this trip was about 69 years old. So you don't have to be young. We often think of kids going off and doing mission trips, but it's for everybody.
Yeah. So was it all right just to be away, unplugged? I assume that you got nothing for 8 days. Was that healthy?
Well, I actually had remarkably, they've got internet access now.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No telephone, no cell phone or anything, but they have internet. So we turned that on for a couple of hours
each
day just to check our emails and things. Some people refuse to check theirs. I did check mine, I will admit. But, yeah, in the past, it was totally unplugged. It's refreshing, actually.
Is it refreshing or are you a little panicked?
I do not get tense. You know, I go on canoe trips where you actually are totally unplugged, and I enjoy that time.
The others, did they all enjoy that time, that unplugged time? Or?
Well, they did because they're all older. In fact, the youngest person on trip, she's 44. I shouldn't say she's terribly young, but she didn't check her email or anything even once during the week. But she's the leader. She's been going for 14 years, so she looks forward to this just getting away.
Yeah.
You know, in her normal day to day life. All the others on the trip, by the way, were Canadians, and in her day to day life, she's an elementary school teacher in Ontario, and so I think she really enjoys getting. This is like her second home.
All right. So now that you're back, what was the news story that hit you the hardest when you got back?
I think that, you know, that story about the boat accident in Missouri and the woman who
that's
lost nine of her family members. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everybody wanted to say a prayer for her, you know. I mean, it's unbelievable to think that could have happened.
Yeah, it's so tragic. Were there 11 people in the family on the boat?
Yeah.
And
she and a teenage.
And
I think,
nine perished?
Or something got away, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's.
So I think that was the one. I don't think that anything in politics shocks me. So, you know, we got back and we heard about Trump's.
Tweet storm?
Well, we heard about that, but also even just about his press conference about Russia and Putin and things, you know, that's how long we were gone.
Okay.
And I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. When he's getting real heavy handed with Iran, what do you make of that?
Oh, saber rattling.
I
think that a lot of people, I mean, a lot of us, including me, appreciate words and probably Trump uses them in a different way. He's not some philosopher. He's a sophist or whatever you want to say. He uses words as a weapon, and a lot of us value words and what's said. And I think that with him, you have to look at it as a different, something different. It's a tactic that he uses to, you know, win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's probably accustomed to this kind of over the top, all caps kind of, you know, response in the business world. And it's worked well for him there. And I think that he's brought it into politics. And that's why people elected him, was to bring a different style to the White House.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing.
So do you know what the Iranians are thinking when they say you're going to have either the mother of all peace or the mother of all wars? I mean,
well, I do kind of get what they're saying. But I mean, this is looking at it from their perspective, too. Of course, they think that we go back on our word all the time because, you know, an administration changes and then the policy changes. So
right.
I kind of get from their perspective what they're seeing from us, too. But I think that what they don't recognize is like how small potatoes they are in the world compared to the U.S. or in a lot of other countries, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that they're trying to just puff themselves up and make themselves seem much more important than they actually are.
Yeah. So the life of a professor with summers off, it's kind of a good life, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you covet this time, don't you?
Well, I do like going on those mission trips. And
as you should. Any other little getaways? You can head
up
to the North
Shore?
I did.
Before that, you know, the week before that, I was only home for 2 days, but the week before that, I went up to do a conference in Edmonton where I presented a paper, and from there I traveled up to the Arctic Ocean, and that was my first time in the Northwest Territories, first time. Now I've covered all the states and provinces.
Nice.
And I actually came across natives butchering a freshly harvested beluga whale, and I got to eat raw blubber.
Well, that's...
It was awesome.
That's pretty much all of us, Kent. So, welcome to the club. Dr. Kent Kaiser has been my guest. Awfully nice of you to stop by the studio. Great to see you and look forward to our next conversation. We'll take it. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.